CityCast from Explicity.
1,000 and some years ago, there arose in southern India an empire that was among the most remarkable the world has seen. It grew atop the tottering scaffolding and shifting sands of fading dynasties and fierce rivalries, ruthless kings and double-crossing aspirants, myth-burnished, propelled forward by the slow burn of faith and the blazing fires of boundless ambition. It defied a myriad obstacles that came its way, and yet, through all the struggles and violence, it also cultivated and refined an aesthetic sensibility of breathtaking beauty. This was the Chola Empire. And in a dynasty that did not lack for larger-than-life characters, there was one in particular who stood head and shoulders above by the standards of any day. He was Rajaraja Chola, King Squared, King of Kings, a fitting name for this multifaceted man who built one of the world's most glorious empires, for whom a single Raja would be pitifully inadequate, wholly unequal to the magnitude of what he accomplished. He made his mark on the vast and messy canvas of the convoluted socio-political dynamics of his time. No mean feat in an era teeming with ambitious and brutal rulers. He fortified the foundations of what was still then a ragtag kingdom, put into place a meticulously organized system of administration, and led the empire into a period of magnificent splendor and grandeur that reigned supreme in military might, as an economic powerhouse, and in art, architecture, literature, music, dance, and religion. Who was this man, this king of jewels, incomparable Chola, great savior, jewel of the Solar dynasty, lion among kings? He was born Arulmori Varman in 947, the third child of Sundara Chola and Vanaman Mahadevi. His older brother Aditya Karikalan, the crown prince, was killed in suspicious circumstances, and so the younger son ended up being crowned emperor in the year 985. He was close to his older sister Kundavai and had a great deal of respect for his great aunt Sembyan Mahadevi. This alone must have set him apart from the typical male of his time. Rajaraja was clearly a remarkable man with an extraordinary outlook and vision, a Jupiter in a universe of small planets. Narcissistic, ambitious, power-hungry, ruthless, far-sighted, shrewd, compassionate, generous. He makes for a fascinating character study.
There has been a lot of interest of late about the old Tamil kingdom, the Chola Empire. And that's for many reasons. The reason that looms the largest is the recent blockbuster movie Ponniyin Selvan, which is all about the most famous of all the Cholas, King Rajaraja. The movie has found itself politicized by a controversy about what labels to apply to Rajaraja's religion, but that's a subject for better minds than mine. The movie is based on a serialized account in a Tamil magazine, Kalki, written as historical fiction many years ago by this wonderful writer, Krishnamurti. He was called Kalki Krishnamurti because his identity was fused with that of the magazine. His articles ran for several years in the 1950s and then were published as a book that ran into several volumes and over 2,000 pages. Movies are one thing, but closer home, everyone that I know from the south of India has felt a need to learn more about the history of this region. In the national school curriculum, the history of the south was always reduced to a footnote. We were taught very little about our own history. It's hard to understand why. Of course, other than the desire to have North Indian politics dominate the national identity and necessarily marginalize the South. It's not that the history of the South was not as significant as the history of the Northern Empires, about which we were schooled in pitiless detail. For one thing, the Cholas were one of the longest-running empires in all of history. The earliest historic references to the Cholas dates back to 300 BC, And the empire was disestablished only in 1279 AD. That's just shy of 1,600 years. By comparison, the Mughal Empire ran from 1526 to, say, 1857. That's under 350 years. For another, while the Indian region was invaded and occupied variously for thousands of years, the Cholas were significant in their thalassocratic or maritime escapades into Southeast Asia, and their trade routes extended to Guangzhou in China and the Silk Route on the other side. The Cholas ruled the Maldives and Sri Lanka, and clearly they knew where to sail to and whom to fight. There was no greater time in all of the Chola years than during the rule of Rajarajeshwaran that ran from 985 AD to about 1014 AD. That's about three decades. And if you made a list of all the stuff that he had achieved, from infrastructure and construction to military campaigns across the south and overseas, you would find it hard to figure out how someone could do so much in so little time in the present day, leave alone over 1,000 years ago. My guest today is Kamini Dandapani. She is a New York-based corporate executive, Chase Manhattan Bank and McKinsey Consulting being feathers in her plume. Kamini does not call herself a historian. As a hobbyist, though, she started writing a blog about historical places that she had visited in the south of India. There's a link to her blog in the podcast description. She says that Aleph, the reputable publishing house, called and asked her if she would write a book. And she did. And this book is titled Rajaraja Chola, King of Kings. I chose Kamini Dandapani and this book to present on the podcast because it is a wonderfully structured book. The book is broken down into easily digestible chapters, and Kamini strikes no elegant postures in her recounting the rule of one of the most respected kings in all of world history. In the parlance of the present, we might refer to Rajaraja as woke, efficient, and progressive. Kamini's biography of him brings us closer to the history of the South in a way that cannot be replaced by comic books and movies. Kamini is a writer, a historian, a Carnatic singer, a Bharatanatyam dancer, and a trained Western classical pianist. And she joins me now from her home in Manhattan. Kamini Dandapani, welcome to the Literary City.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
You know, as I have just been saying, I can't think of another situation where so little is known publicly about so famous a man. I mean, our school history sucked, didn't it?
Exactly. I mean, this is something I quibble about all the time. I mean, I'm the last person to say that one history is better or worse or superior, inferior, nothing like that.
Right.
But our history that we were taught was very North India centric. So we had the Mauryas, the Guptas, the Mughals, and then the British, and then the independence movement. I don't think we even heard about the Cholas or Pallavas or anything like that. So if we did, there was one paragraph that was tucked in somewhere.
Footnote.
Footnote.
So, barring Kalki Krishnamurti, we only have the comic book versions of Rajaraja.
Exactly, exactly.
It's something of a travesty that South Indians don't know South Indian history.
Yes.
Right.
You're absolutely right. And the little bit that we do know is a kind of a Disneyland version. There are movies that are so far out there, you can just laugh. You know, just have a good laugh.
But now that you've written this properly researched book, people must be coming up to you all the time and thanking you for doing it. You must hear this all the time, right?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Do you ever wish you could sit in on a conversation with some of your favorite authors and listen to them talk about their writing process, their path to publication, and of course, their newest novels? Hi, I'm Marissa Meyer, bestselling author of The Lunar Chronicles, and I would love for you to check out the Happy Writer podcast, where every week I talk with other writers about books, craft, inspiration, and how to bring a little more joy into our lives. The Happy Writer is available wherever you get your podcasts or find us on Instagram at Happy Writer Podcast.
Yes, that's definitely a common thread. Everybody, most people, just like what you said just now, they hated history growing up in school because of the way it was taught. It's
right,
just regurgitated. dates and names without any interesting facts there. Right. But I also think that in all of us, at some point in life, a switch gets turned on where we suddenly start becoming curious about our history.
Yes.
And then in my case, it was reading books like by somebody like William Dalrymple that really opened my eyes to how, and he was my, when I read The City of Jinns, I was like, wow, you know, I lived in Delhi for a few years and I wish I had read it then when I was there in Delhi. And that a history could be, you know, presented in this fashion was kind of eye-opening to me. So in some ways, he was my inspiration. He is my inspiration. And the other thing is, you know, my kids are growing up here, not that they're interested, but I thought I'd start a blog and write about South India. Just, it covers a wide range of things. I mean, South India.
I've read it. I've read your blog.
Okay. So that's just to kind of tell them what South India is about, you know, without being pedantic and just giving them different kinds of stories about it. And it was a kind of a fairy tale thing, I guess, because the publisher, Aleph, somebody, I guess, saw it and they approached me and asked me if I would write this book. And I said, I'm not a historian. Yeah. And they said, that's precisely why we're asking you, because we don't want a scholarly, you know, dense academic kind of a book. We want something that can be read by the layperson. So that's how that happened. And
wonderful.
Yeah, but there are some wonderful writers out there today also writing these kind of histories. So
yeah.
I'm hopeful.
Getting to your subject, Rajaraja, he ruled from 985 to 1014 AD. Let's get some perspective here. Now, in the fullness of the history that we know, how long is that? Let's throw a dart at it.
Okay.
Call it 6,000 years.
Yes.
985 is more than the halfway mark. It's closer to us than them.
That's definitely one way of looking at it. Yes.
So put into perspective.
Okay.
985 AD seems like so long ago for a man like Rajaraja to be taking the strategic decisions that he did.
Mm-hmm.
But think about it. So much had already happened in history by then, hadn't it?
Exactly. Yeah.
So let's see. Jainism and Buddhism were already about 1,100 years old. The Achaemenid Empire was 1,000 years old. Christianity, St. Thomas in the same area was already had arrived 900 years before Rajaraja. Islam was more than 300 years before him. And let's not forget that his own empire, the Chola Empire, was over 1,000 years old at that point.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes, yes.
So he must have lived among Christians, among Muslims, and in a well-developed society. So tell me, as a Rajaraja scholar, what sense of history do you think he had?
Well, you just said it just now. I think he definitely brought all those centuries of history into how he thought and how he ruled. I think Rajaraja was a man who had a very deep sense of history. And you can see that in a lot of his actions. And the world, we think of, you know, what we call it, like globalization as something new. I don't think so at all. It has been going on ever since, you know, for millennia.
I agree.
Point. So even the earlier Cholas, Sangam Cholas, who lived 2,000 years ago, had people from, you know, Greece and Rome come and trade with them. There have been coins from those times found there. There have been accounts of people traveling back and forth. So, yes, we didn't have Google then, but there were other means of communication, you know. So I think there was a lot of communication going back and forth. There was a lot of people traveling up and down to different parts, to China, to Southeast Asia, to Egypt, to the Fatimid dynasty, to those parts of the world. And I think Rajaraja was definitely had his ear to the ground, figuring out what was going on. You know, for instance, he sent an expedition to China, a trade mission to China. How did he know that this was the place to go to? You know, so he was aware that he had people come and report to him that this place is offering trade benefits and it would be good to kind of set up a good trading partnership. He was aware that the Srivijaya kingdom to his east was vying for the same piece of the pie. And he was aware that he needed to do something to kind of overtake them and get to the Chinese. Similarly, a horse trader is who told him that there was anarchy and chaos in Sri Lanka, and he launched his attack over there. And the Cholas themselves had a sense of history going back way into the past.
So what evidence is there of any structured education in the day?
frankly, we just have like snippets that they have these Brahmin villages in which the children there were taught the Vedas and the scriptures. And I don't know who read and wrote, because I talked about the inscriptions on the walls. I doubt that the general public were able to read that, but there were certainly scribes who would have read them aloud to people. So what the level of literacy was, I don't know, but I'm guessing it's low. It was just a certain segment of society who could read and write. But education also covered the martial arts. For instance, they said Rajaraja had his son Rajendra well-educated across a multitude of fields that included, you know, horseback riding, elephant fighting, archery. So those were considered important in an era when, you know, that's how you built your empire. But then they also said he learned the scriptures and that kind of thing. So what else they studied, I honestly don't know.
So how did they write? We know about the Virakala, the hero stones, the temple inscriptions, but it couldn't have all been stone.
Right? But they were also on palm leaf for manuscripts.
Okay.
So I think the whatever, for instance, if you gave an order or a grant, it was first inscribed on palm leaf documents, and then they were subsequently transferred to stone.
But the palm leaves survived, didn't they? I mean, everything we know from the Sangam period came from palm leaves. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's kind of mind-boggling if you think about it. So they must have had some technology to preserve these palm leaves, but then they were eventually discovered only in the 19th and 20th century, rotting away in attics and, you know,
right,
other places.
But not rotting enough, right? I mean, a leaf falls in your garden and a few hours later, it's gone.
Totally. Yeah, so I guess it was processed in some way to make it last longer. It is, if you go to the Saraswati Mahal Library in Thanjavur, they have some of those.
Never been there.
It is a remarkable collection.
Right. But let's not also forget that these are the guys that made steel in 600 BC, exported it to the Middle East, from where the famous Damascus swords were made, right?
Exactly, yes.
Now back to Rajaraja. Yes. You say that when he was born, there was great fanfare and trumpets were sounded and so on. And people spoke of the birth of a new king. They foretold this, right? Were they just in a mood?
I think they were in a mood to say so. Because remember I said Cholas were masters at PR, at public relations. I think they mastered the art of social media and image projection way ahead before any of these became buzzwords.
That's cool.
So the truth is that it was Rajaraja's brother who was earmarked, who was supposed to become the king. So why would there be all this fanfare when Rajaraja was born, you know? But they had to say all that he was born, he had the mark of Vishnu on his, on his arms, and you know, all these bells rang and things like that. So it was all just to create this buzz that this great man is here on earth. And so much of history is like retrofitted. You kind of create all this image after the fact.
So fake news is not new, huh?
Fake news is not new at all, son. There are gullible people always.
Rajaraja the Great. Now, great is normally accorded to kings who win great battles, and it's military prowess and success normally. Now, you wrote that for the first several years of his reign, one didn't see too many hero stones extolling his exploits. You said that he was a good administrator and wanted to get things right. That would be remarkable.
It is. And I think it speaks to a certain maturity to Rajaraja. I mentioned early on in his chapter that he had a long apprenticeship, first under his father and then his uncle, where he saw the ups and downs that the kingdoms went through and what it took to kind of push the kingdom forward. So I think he focused on, you know, getting the house in order, attacking those kingdoms that needed to be attacked, primarily the Pandyas to the south, the Cheras to the west. And I guess he didn't blow his trumpet until he felt it was time to do that.
Now, isn't that the hallmark of an educated man?
It is, of a mature, educated man. I do think so. And I think Rajaraja was a mature person. He was, his thinking was not, let's just kind of blindly, you know, go in there and attack, but let's do it methodically and let's bide our time, you know. So
you speak highly of his administrative skills. In fact, you spend a lot of time outlining those practices.
that was a difficult chapter to write because it's like, it's tedious. And it's all the evidence is from his inscriptions, you know. So again, when I said earlier that Rajaraja had a keen sense of history, I really believe that he recorded everything that he did. So when he commissioned his land survey, that was recorded, you know, and he named the person who did it, and everything was inscribed on temple walls, because I think if there was a dispute or if there was any kind of questioning, you go to that wall and say, here it is, you know, it's proven. And he standardized everything. So as I said earlier, he inherited a kingdom that was very kind of diverse, to put it mildly. You know, there were people from the hills, there were people from the river delta, there were multiple castes of people, and they were all kind of brought together. So he had to kind of come up with a standardized way of running the whole thing. So everything, all the sources of information are inscriptions. And there are some amazing historians who have, you know, analyzed all the inscriptions, come up with the kind of data based on inscription analysis to get information on land ownership, who owned the land, how these villages were organized. You have inscriptions about village committees and how you got elected to the committee. And the level of detail is mind-boggling. It's really mind-boggling. And, you know, by a tip of my hat to the historians who went through this stuff, it's Chola inscriptions are, I think, the most numerous of all inscriptions. I mean, they inscribed everything on their walls.
As a young Tamil boy, I got into trouble for scribbling on my walls.
Yes. Yeah, you're allowed to do it, so...
You know, another thing that they say is that India didn't conduct military campaigns outside India, but that's not true of Rajaraja, was it? Now,
yes.
I mean, he went everywhere, didn't he?
He did go everywhere, but he did not, nor did his son, actually colonize them, meaning he was not their ruler or king. And again, the acid test is the inscriptions. His inscriptions were not there. But I think what he did was have them under a tight leash and say, you better listen to me.
Uh-huh.
And you do as I say. And I think there were Chola women married to, you know, princelings and kings and things from those parts. The only place they actually colonized was Sri Lanka, that is outside the mainland of India. And that proved very, very difficult. You know, that was constantly, they did not like being under the Chola thumb, and there were constantly, you know, rebellions breaking out. And so it was for a short while, actually, that Sri Lanka remained a Chola territory. And they wanted it because it was rich in copper. In fact, there's a theory that a lot of the copper that came to make the Chola bronzes came from Sri Lanka. They were part of the trade route that went further east. And I think the pearl fisheries were also valuable to the Cholas because they used the pearls for the jewels for their idols and things like that. But they did not colonize, contrary to what is believed, they did not actually colonize Southeast Asia, except perhaps culturally. So if you go there, you know, the religion and the Hindu parts there that probably came from the Pallavas.
Well, we can't blame him for the Thai people mixing up our epics now, can we?
Yes.
He also annexed the Maldives, didn't he?
Yes, Maldives. Yes, he went, he attacked what they think are the Maldives in off the west coast of India. They call it the 12,000 old islands of the sea or something like that. So again, those islands were also part of the trading route that, you know, came from Egypt and the Persian Gulf. When he one of his first military expeditions was against Kerala, actually, the Chera kingdom.
Right. I mean, he got into a snit with that guy and went there and chopped off his head.
These guys took offense when I, God knows what. So it's kind of funny, actually. So, but I think the Cheras, the Kerala people probably controlled those trade ports. So this was one way of getting a hold of that.
Your book is very interesting and it clearly explains why you picked Rajaraja as your subject. A question. Mm-hmm. Many of your chapter titles have sun and moon motifs.
Yes. I did that deliberately because they're part of the solar dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of, I decided to use that whenever I could, actually.
Very nice theme. So, did you pick those chapter titles yourself?
Yeah, I did all the titles myself. Yes. So the book cover also, they kind of played on that and they had that big shiny sun on the cover. But nice yeah, it touch. Was, I kind of thought.
You know, the way you describe the politics that Rajaraja had to endure, different people in the Kaveri Basin, other people squabbling, different factions. You could be describing modern Tamil Nadu politics.
Totally, Ramji, because, you know, you read and then you realize everything moves in a cycle. You think it's linear. It is not. It's everything is going to go one way and then come back. So put in that, I guess.
Okay,
that.
Let's talk about the movie now. I really don't want to, but it is the elephant in the room.
It is the elephant in the room, yes. So what do you want me to talk about, the movie or the controversy?
First, when did you start writing this book?
I'd say about 4 or 5 years back, but I had a kind of a health thing in the middle, so that had to take a back seat. But yeah, it's been about 4 or 5 years. So well, before the movie.
Complete coincidence?
It is totally coincidental, and I'm hoping to ride on the coattails of the movie. Why not, you know? So,
As
anyway.
Indeed you should. It's a wonderful book. And for our listeners, there's a link in the podcast description to where you can buy a copy of Rajaraja Chola, King of Kings by Kamini Dandapani. And now for some trivial questions. You said that he was the son of Vanaman Mahadevi and Sundara Chola.
He was the son of Vanaman Mahadevi, yes.
And mm-hmm. his wife was also Vanaman Mahadevi.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So these were not names, actually titles. So they were kind of modern.
Too many Vanaman Mahadevis. Common name?
Probably that too, but I don't think those were their birth names.
Ah.
So I think it kind of implied where they came from or, you know, what clan they belong to, something like that. Because I read somewhere that I think it is Panchavan meant a Pandya connection. So this is something I didn't probe too deeply into, but they were all monikers given to the queen. And so they all have, there's a handful of names and it's very confusing. Because
certainly clears it up.
Yes.
You know, you end your book with a number of adjectives, sublime, luminous. Did you feel that way or did you just fall in love with your subject?
I never fell in love with him, but I did. You know, you step back and you say, wow, you know, here we are over 1,000 years later talking about him. That must mean something, right?
He
was in this little corner of India and he kind of made a mark. And he pushed his boundaries beyond anything that had been done that far. He did everything on a grand scale. So I don't think he would be the ideal dinner party companion. No, I would not like to sit there because he'd probably dominate everything and maybe behead a person or two. But definitely there is admiration. I admire the man, certainly. So I may not like him, but I certainly, certainly admire him. And I meant all those glowing words. So.
Yes, that's very clear. And proof of that is what you named your dog.
Well, the dog came earlier. He's just Roger. He was first named after Roger Federer.
I see.
But then I used to call him Roger Chola and I said, why not? So.
Well, game, set and match to Roger Chola over Roger Federer. Well, on that wonderful note, Kamini Dandapani, thank you so much for being my guest today on The Literary City.
Thank you. I really, really enjoyed it. Thank you very much for having me here.
My pleasure entirely. And that was Kamini Dandapani, author of Rajaraja Chola, King of Kings. And I'll be back with What's That Word? That fun segment where we look at words and phrases that we use all the time but never stop to think about. In a minute, or less than a minute, depending on where you are. And I'm back. This is What's That Word? And this is my co-host.
Hello. My name is Pranati. But you can call me P. That's P with an A, not another E.
And hello to you, P in the P with an A. Hey, how is your Chola sentiment all stoked?
And how? You know, I had no interest in watching this Ponniyin Selvan movie.
Mm-hmm.
But that interview with Kamini Dandapani, it has me very interested, you know. That was a lovely conversation.
Thank you. It was very enjoyable.
Yeah. And in your monologue, you talked about the different attempts to fictionalize the story of Rajaraja.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember something about a previous movie, and I think it was also called Ponniyin Selvan.
Yes, that's right. It never got made. You know, there have been many attempts. Now, for one thing, MGR, for our overseas listeners, M.G. Ramachandran was one of the biggest movie stars, and then he was the chief minister of Tamil Nadu state for many years. MGR tried making the movie in the late 1950s, but apparently he had problems getting financing, and it was shelved. Then in the early 1990s, Kamala Hassan, another huge movie star, tried turning it into a TV series, but that idea too got nowhere. Many years, many attempts later, here it is.
Right, but is it a fictionalized history? I mean, there has been some criticism.
Why not? My view is that movies are there not to educate. They exist to entertain, right? I mean, people ought to pursue history by themselves and not expect movie makers to become history professors.
Right. I dare say they would do a better job than our high school history teachers.
I submit. But I believe those things are called documentaries.
Right, of course.
And there are some wonderful history books available on Rajaraja. I dipped into quite a few prepping for this interview. Gripping potboilers.
Another thing you said was that the writer was referred to as Kalki Krishnamurti. So his identity became his name. I mean, how do people get these monikers?
It's a Tamil thing, okay? I'm sure that it's used in many cultures, but I'm familiar with this business of someone's employer's name being used to identify that someone.
Wow, how convenient.
Maybe, but there have been some hilarious results.
Really? Do tell. I love hilarity.
So there was this guy in my neighborhood when I lived in Delhi. His name was either Sambamurti or Sambashivam or something like that. Anyway, of course, he was called Sam for short, right?
Of course.
And he worked for the airline Pan Am. So the name on his gatepost read Pan Am Sam.
That's clever.
Well, that one's sort of cool. Spare a thought for this guy, my parents' friend, Rajaratnam, who worked for a leatherette making company called Bohr. Spelled B-H-O-R.
Oh, no. And they called him Bohr Rajaratnam.
That is the funny, yes. And it didn't help that he was not a sparkling wit and dazzling conversationalist. You know, tell him I'm not home was a lie that I was taught early in life.
Poor guy. How did he live it down?
Well, people were cooler back then. He would call and introduce himself. And he would say, this is Bohr Rajaratnam speaking.
Sweet. Well, he was a sport.
Like turtle racing?
Okay, stop. I don't want to know any more of this absurd Tamil humor. I've had enough.
Okay, P with an A. What's that word?
So, usually, we pick familiar words and phrases, mm-hmm. but I have been dying to ask you this one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you mentioned Chola Steel in your interview.
Yes, what about it?
Well, I had read a phrase in reference to the Damascus sword.
Ah.
I read it somewhere years ago, but mm-hmm. filed it away in my mind.
Okay.
So this guy grips his Damascus sword and threatens, I will give you an Indian answer.
Yes, I know that one. You know, no one should experience that.
But what does it mean? And am I right to suspect it has something to do with that steel?
It totally does. So he grips his Damascus sword and says, I'll give you an Indian answer. Let me explain. So first the meaning. You know, starting from 600 BC, there was manufacture and export of steel from the Chola Empire, presumably through the traders from the Cheras in the west. This steel is called Woots steel, which is probably a corruption of the Tamil word Uruku or Ukku in Kannada, for instance. And it was unknown to civilizations outside India, the making of the steel, I mean. But the toughness of that metal was used to make that distinctively shaped Damascus sword. It's curved. It's like a scimitar, but thinner and hard.
That's what she said.
Ooh, good one. Anyway, therefore, it could be sharpened when needed, unlike other metals, and it would just cut through all other weapons.
Wow, must have been a great weapon. So are there accounts of it in battle?
Tons of accounts of the Damascus sword in battle. It was used widely and well. But there is this one fascinating story of Alexander, you know, the great, that one. He was returning to Greece, and he was gifted 100 talents of steel pellets, or was it ingots, by King Porus of Sindh.
What's a talent?
The same weight as a tola.
And what's a tola?
180 troy grains.
Okay, I'll play. What's 180 grains in real numbers?
3/8 of a troy ounce.
Okay, fine. You win.
All right. It's just shy of 12 grams.
There. Now I can breathe again. Okay. So tell me about the unkindest cut of all, please.
Unkindest cut of all. Hey, you know, that's a phrase for a future. What's that word? Good. All right. Right. So with this steel, the Arabs and the Persians made the famous Damascus swords, with which they silenced their enemies. So when the Arabs cut off someone's head with that sword, they called it the Jawab al-Hind, or the Indian answer.
Nice to be renowned for decapitation.
That renowned. Yeah, but the sword was much respected.
Yeah. Where else do the references occur?
Well, you see, the fame of the Wootz steel was such that it was coveted in all of Europe and the Middle East because the world had seen nothing like it before. There's even a King Arthur reference.
Oh, wow. Do tell.
So in this book by Sir Walter Scott, The Talisman is a, you know, it's a work of fiction. It's based on the Third Crusade that took place towards the end of the 12th century. And I think about 1185, 1187, 80, thereabouts. Anyway, this story contains a narration of this encounter that happened between King Richard the Lionhearted and Sultan Salahuddin, you know, commonly known as Saladin. So that name always made me laugh, Saladin. You know, it's neither a salad nor Aladdin. Anyway, so Richard the Lionheart breaks a steel bar into two with a single slash from his sword Oblivion. And in response, Saladin slashes a wisp of silk using his Damascus sword. Now, astounded by this, Richard said that even the famed sword Excalibur of King Arthur could not cut through something like silk. Now, you think, why was that? See, silk offers no resistance. So think about being able to slice through something in the air that's like silk. It's the steel was that sharp. And that could only be done by something as tensile as steel.
So what happened? Where's the steel now?
It's been lost to history. Long story, the iron that was used to make this wood steel was being mined in a forest in the south of India. But the forest is now protected, has long been protected, and the source is all dried out, so no more mining there. Anyway, let me tell you that there's this wonderful account of the steel by two professors from Bangalore. You can Google it. It's all over the internet as to what was the chemical composition of the steel, the metallurgy of it all, so to speak. But it's all available out there.
Cool. Now, my last question. Mm-hmm. Why is it called the Damascus sword? How does Syria come into it?
That's a tad murky. The popular version is that the city of Damascus has little to do with it. Or maybe it did. We don't know. But what is more commonly accepted is that it was called Damascus because the surface of the steel had wavy patterns on it. And the Arabs called it Damas. Now, in Arabic, the word ma is water. So start deriving from there, right? So Damas means watery, but the more likely meaning of the word is wavy or even shimmery.
Like that jewelry company in Dubai, Damas.
You know, I didn't think of that. You're right. Principally known for gold, probably because of its shimmery nature. Yeah, good. Yeah, probably.
Yeah, this is all very interesting. You know, everything is so connected.
Except the head of the guy who was given the Indian answer.
Okay, I will now think of things that don't give me nightmares. Bye.
And that is our show. I would like to thank my guest, Kamini Dandapani, my co-host, Pranathi P with an A, Mother, and you for being here and for listening. Now, before you go, hit that subscribe button. Never miss an episode of The Literary City. Have a great week and see you again next Wednesday.